I added also to the title and magnetic field, since there was a lot of discussion during this meeting and a lot of interest about magnetic field. So I'm for sure I'm not going to squeeze everything in 20 minutes what I wanted to say. But one thing to point at the beginning is that the extragalactic jet spends a lot, like a huge scale. So we can probe them pure Schwarzschild radii, basically, from the supermassive black hole 10 to 14 centimeters, up to megaparsec scales. And the same problem that is present in every astrophysical object, namely that the scales and processes we can probe with particle and cell simulations are completely different than the scales at which the emission processes, let's say, the emission that we observe is due to the is only non-thermal emission, so it's due to ultra-relativistic particles. So the characteristic scales for these are completely different than, let's say, plasma scales. And then the global structure is yet another range of scales. And so it's not possible to address everything about the jets in some kind of one numerical simulation. We have to use a hybrid approach, and the same observationally, we have to use many different instruments with different resolution and different energy range to really understand those jets. What we see, however, is that from those subparsec to megaparsec scale is a stream of well-collimated plasma. And at the beginning, we saw mostly only radio polarized emission, so we know that this is the synchrotron emission, and there are ultra-relativistic electrons and magnetic field, but we didn't know much more observationally till the new instruments came and we started to observe them at other frequencies. So the central engine is a supermassive black hole, and it's just a few slides to put it in some broader context. And we have many evidences that every galaxy has a supermassive black hole, and that the supermassive black hole is accreting material, and that some of these supermassive black hole are active, therefore producing jets. And so just from first principle, we could say that if there is a large-scale magnetic field, let's say poloidal magnetic field, close to the rotating supermassive black hole, for example, supported, of course, because a supermassive black hole, as it was in the previous slide, cannot have its own magnetic field, so it has to be supported by the accretion disk, by the currents within the accretion disk. But let's say there is some kind of poloidal large-scale magnetic field, then if we could somehow make it that the currents are flowing along the magnetic field lines, let's say here the magnetic field is so strong that there is a force-free approximation holds, but then at some larger distance force-free breaks, the currents can flow across the magnetic field lines, and the let's say the loop is closed. So if we could do this, in principle, the potential drop from first principle we can estimate would be like this, and the maximum power extracted would be this. And this is very encouraging because this is exactly the range of total kinetic luminosities of jet that we are talking about. Note here that depends on the spin of the black hole. So of course this extraction of the energy from the black hole is possible only when the black hole is rotating. It's also interesting to note in the context of particle acceleration that this potential drop would imply that E delta V, and so the maximum energy of the particle that could be in principle somehow accelerated, is in this range. So this is exactly the highest energy cosmic rays detected by Pierre-Roger and also previous cosmic ray experiments. Hence the idea that those kind of supermassive black hole are accelerators of the highest energy particles. So how to extract this power in principle was discussed in details by Blandford and Znaig in 77. I don't have time to go into the details of this process. Just very roughly is that we have magnetic field which is due to the accreting matter, even if we don't start from the large scale magnetic field from the beginning, as shown by a number of simulations. Accretion disks are supposed to create such a magnetic field due to MRI instabilities, and then this magnetic field is dragged with the accreting matter, enter the ergosphere where it's twisted, and so we have this kind of twist propagating outwards. And from the poloidal magnetic field, we launch the highly magnetized jet with the dominant, very quickly toroidal component of the magnetic field. The thing is that, again, energetically, the total energy that you can extract in this way is of this order, the reducible energy of the supermassive rotating supermassive black hole. And this is again the range which is inferred from the observation of clusters when we see a huge cavities inflated by the jet. So energetically, it seems to be the case, and also the spin dependence seems to be really the case. But the point is that we expect the jet to be launched with the dynamically dominant magnetic field. So what about the observations? Those regions when the jets are launched cannot be, of course, resolved by any instruments. But if the jet, there are many evidences that the jets from the almost very beginning are relativistic, moving with Black Lorentz factor of the order of 10 to 60. So if the jet, as Greg said, is pointing close to our line of sight, the emission of the jet is strongly Doppler boosted and dominates everything, the light from the accretion disk and the galaxy, etc. So we see basically only the non-thermal emission of the jet, of the inner portion of the jet, unresolved jet, in all the cases unresolved. And we learn with EGRET that actually the gamma ray emission dominates the total radiative output of such sources, the most powerful, and this is one of the examples. And so the ideas for because of the polarization, we knew that this is a synchrotron component. There was a debate, what is this component? Is it due to the leptonic processes? So inverse Compton emission, either SSC or some external photons, or is it hadronic in origin? And in fact, the first laser models were kind of hadronic because at that time, I was told that people believed that it's not possible to accelerate electrons directly, that you have to, the electrons, ultra-physical electrons can be only secondary, so you accelerate only protons, let's say, at the shock, and then you create the electrons as secondaries. So hence the idea that you accelerate protons and you have a high energy emission due to proton processes like photomeson production or synchrotron emission of ultra-physical protons. All what we learned till that time is that these hadronic processes are not the case. There are many problems that cannot explain variability, and there's many, many other problems, while leptonic models are pretty successful. So very roughly, as Greg said, so we imagine that we have a jet, some kind of, let's say, different shells colliding, creating shock. You have a particle acceleration there. So you create ultra-resistive electrons, and they produce synchrotron and inverse Compton due to different emission fields around the jet. And this is just to plot the different emission fields that we have in case of powerful quasars, so emission from the disk, all in the jet west frame. Due to dusty tori, this is energy density of the magnetic field, disk, synchrotron emission, and broad line region. Very roughly, we can produce this blazar emission and this scale from 0.1 parsec up to, let's say, 1 parsec. This is the scale of interest. The modeling of the broadline emission suggests that the emission region size are kind of compact. However, they are located pretty far from the nucleus. The emission region is relativistic. And what is interesting is that the energy density of the magnetic field is very roughly in equipartition with energy density of the electrons. As I said, the hadronic models have problems in explaining broadband properties of the blazars, but there are some evidences for the dynamical role of the protons, in fact, in the jet, of the cold protons. And that is because when we compute the total radiated power of many objects, so these are different classes of blazar, never mind, so you see that this is the total radiated power. And from this leptonic modeling, we can compute the power, pointing flux, and the power carried by the electrons. And as you see, it's never enough to account for the total emitted power. So we have to have something else. And what is this something else? Either the protons that we don't see any radiation of, these so-called protons, called electrons maybe, or magnetic field. However, from this modeling, because of this inverse Compton peak is so strong, magnetic field cannot be that strong, so we are left with particles. And we can also exclude cold electrons. So we can exclude the number of cold electrons. It's simply because if there is too many cold electrons in a jet, we would expect, in addition to the non-thermal emission, so-called bulk Compton emission, when the disk UV emission is upscattered by cold electrons. And for the jet Lorentz factor gamma, we will have something like a soft X-ray excess, and we don't observe this excess. So from the lack of the soft X-ray excess, we can compute, you know, the power carried by cold electrons. So we are left with protons. However, these are cold protons, not relativistic protons. So what are the spectra of the powerful blazars? Now I will be talking about these most powerful blazars called flat spectrum radio quasars. this is the example of this. We had a multi-wavelength campaign led by Jun Kataoka, and this is the very typical spectrum that we see. So here this, by the way, the emission of the accretion disk, dusty tori, the synchrotron emission produced in a farther portion of the jet, and this is the inverse Compton peak with the old egret data. The point is that what we see, that this is the typical electron spectrum, and this is very universal for those sources. So it's very, very flat at below, let's say, 100 Lorentz factor of the electrons, and very steep farther out. The modelings, all the parameters given, note the ratio of electron to proton 10, so we have much more electron to proton pairs. However, dynamically, proton dominates. So most of the power is carried by the protons. I call it shock spectra because when we discuss this in also in other sources, we think that this is self-consistent scenario, namely that the spectrum gives us some kind of characteristic energy at large scale from the black hole, one parsec, so this is like 10 to 5 Schwarzschild radii, when we could suspect that the initially pointing-dominated jet is converted to the matter-dominated jet by some processes. And so it's proton-dominated, and therefore the shock will be proton-mediated, and therefore the inertia of cold proton would give us some characteristic scale. So just to say that this kind of very, very flat X-ray spectra suggesting very, very flat, low-energy continua of radiating electrons is something common. Whenever we look at powerful quasars, this is the compilation, X-ray spectral indices are very, very flat, suggesting spectral index of electrons in this range. So why I said that this, we believe something like, and I will come back to this point later, is that, so how to form this kind of spectrum? So we believe that if the shock, let's say if the emission acceleration of particles at this scale is really due to the shock acceleration, and these are transfer relativistic shock mediated by the protons, then the electrons with the gyre radii, let's say smaller than the proton gyre radii, cannot undergo first order Fermi acceleration simply because they are trapped in the velocity transition zone. However, they can be accelerated due to the other processes, like for example discussed by Hoshino and recently by Amato and Arons, when the electrons absorb the cyclotron emission of cold protons reflected from the shock front. And interestingly, with this recent simulation by Amato and Arons, the spectral indices obtained for those low energy particles are in agreement with this. So what about the high energy part? We believe that it can be due to the diffusive shock acceleration and the relativistic shock. So these are the simulation, recent simulations from Niemiec and Ostrowski, Monte Carlo simulation. What we see from this simulation, what is emerged, that if we have relativistic shock, there is of course nothing like a universal spectrum of the electrons. And the form spectra depends very much on the configuration of the magnetic field. So this is, for example, the angle between magnetic field and the shock normal, velocity. So this is subluminal configuration, this is superluminal. And the spectrum of the turbulence. You see really variety of spectra produced, and mostly for superluminal configuration, which seems to be most likely in the case of relativistic shocks, very, very steep spectra. So this is about the most powerful quasars, but what about the low power objects, BLACs, that are detected in TV? So they dominate basically extragalactic TV sky. The thing is that from these sources, while the powerful quasars vary on characteristic timescale 20 days, that is consistent with emission site being far away from the nucleus, those vary very rapidly. So this is a huge outburst in TV on the timescale of 200 seconds. And that suggests that the emission size is very close to the nucleus. And can we even think that there are some shocks, if you like all what we know about the jet launching suggests dominating magnetic fields? So it's hard to think about standard, hydro shocks formed at, few Schwarzschild radii, basically. And indeed, what I wanted to point out, that the spectra of these sources looks really different. Namely, sometimes if we don't have a good data, we fit with a power law, but when we look at details, this X-ray spectra, and as Greg said, in X-rays, those objects, they are picked at high energy, so the synchrotron continuum peaks in X-rays, while the inverse Compton at TeV is always of, let's say, curved shape, which is like just for fitting is this form. And we see this kind of curvature up to UV band. And this is true for all TeV emitting BLACs. So maybe the main, another example, very recent, analyzing UV data. And this is, I don't have time to go into the the issue of the TEV spectrum, but also when corrected for the EB absorption on extracting background light, suggests very, very flat spectrum at low energy. So this kind of curvature, this kind of curved spectra, is something we expect from the energy distribution that will be ultra-V-sigma Maxwellian. So then I will skip everything about the polarization properties on the parsec scales and go to the farther scales. I wanted to move farther out. So I wanted to say that when we model the blazars, we typically get constrained that they are already matter dominated. Then we go to the parsec scales that can be already resolved by VLBI. And there are several indications from the polarization structure. Many people claim that they are actually still dominated by the magnetic field. So either we are completely wrong in modeling blazar emission, or those radio observations have to be in the other way. So since Jonathan Arons asked about the HST1 knot, another thing is that matter versus pointing dominated is that in jets, we typically observe very, very gradual collimation of the jet. So this is the opening angle in M87. You can see at the beginning 60 degrees opening angle. Continue slowly collimating up to 100 parsecs to 10 degrees. This kind of slow collimation is a typically is like a prediction basically of the magnetic models when the jet is really slowly collimating. However, the same can be explained by so-called reconfinement shock. And then when the free expanding jet is collimated by the pressure of the ambient medium. And then we expect formation of the so-called reconfinement nozzle. And this is very interesting that indeed in M87 jet, at the scale where we expect this collimation nozzle to form, we observe this variable knot HST1, which is interesting in the context of TV emission by Hess of M87, because when it was flaring in X-ray and Aneta was showing this light curve, we observed also this is the TV Hess light curve. So kind of nicely coincident. In addition, just at the top of this maximum, the HST1 knot started to emit the superluminal blobs. So we very often hear in the literature that the superluminal blobs observed by VLBI are originating close to the black hole, and then we observe them. Here, in the first 100 parsec scale, we see nothing. The jet is featureless. And the blobs emerge from this stationary feature. So it's interesting. Anyway, talking about particle accelerations of 5 minutes for large scales. So that was I was to talk mostly. So on large scales, let's say we still have this difference between low power jet and high power jet. And we see this difference in morphology, radiative properties, and polarization properties. To mention that it was very interesting discovery of the people doing so-called spectral radiotomography for years, Larry Rudnick and the others, and they put a paper in 2005 when they claimed that all the low-power jet FR1 jets, like that they have this kind of morphology, have the low-energy spectra, which is not 0.5 but 0.55 even. Well, you can see how significant it is. These are the measurements. This is 0.5, 0.6. But they really claim that this is significant. That would imply that the universal spectrum in those jets, electron spectrum, is of this form that is claimed to be for, like, let's say, relativistic shock diffuse acceleration spectrum. So this is a low energy spectrum. What about the high energy spectra? In M87, we can probe the jet and the polarization in optical radio in X-ray as well. We can also construct the broadband energy distribution at different portions of the jet. So this is nucleus and then different knots. So what you see, this is always of this form. One thing to point out is that this is synchrotron emission up to X-rays. So that requires already presence of 100 TeV energy electrons. And we don't understand exactly formation of this high energy continuum. If this is roughly 0.5, 0.6, so standard, let's say, spectrum, this kind of break cannot be due to the cooling, and we see kind of variety. So this high energy part is kind of problematic. And of course, because the X-ray jet is also continuous, as Aneta mentioned, we need to have some acceleration all along the jet. And I will skip this. When we look in X-rays in other FR1 jets, like Centaurus A, and here we coded 600 kiloseconds Chandra exposure, so we could study, and we excluded all the sources, like point sources, for example, knots from the jet, just to study the diffuse component. What is very interesting is that, so on the previous slide, there was this, let's say, scale at which we expect cooling of the X-ray emitting synchrotron electrons, few tens of parsecs. This is 4 kiloparsec, and this is the profile of this diffuse component after subtraction of all the nodes, what is interesting that along the jet and also across the jet, even though we see some intensity changes, and for example here the boundary structure, the spectral index is just constant. It's just one. We don't see any, and this is 4 kiloparsec versus cooling scale 10 parsec. So then powerful jets is a different story. Aneta said about this detection of the Chandra, the X-ray emission, and is much higher than extrapolation of. Okay, so one thing to note is that okay, the inverse Compton model. So the model that we have this, that would be let's say the most standard. We have just a power law energy distribution, synchrotron inverse Compton on CMB. Because of the low energy density of CMB, we have to have a beaming, because in relativistic jet, in a rest frame, the CMB energy density is enhanced. Therefore, we need the beaming to explain this, like to produce this nice feed. And the idea was that it's consistent because all the X-ray jets are one-sided. However, one thing is that for 3C2353, in fact, we detected the counter jet, the counter node, which has exactly the same spectrum like the nodes. So it cannot be any beaming here. So something is wrong. And when we look at the 3C273, so also very powerful jet, and we see again the same story, radio, infrared, optical suggesting one component, and then X-ray suggesting different components, so naturally CMB. The thing is that this emission is polarized, so it cannot be inverse Compton. So we clearly see non-standard spectrum. While also to note in the context of the acceleration continuous versus shock, that it was pointed by Jesser et al. And Meisenheimer and collaborators, that here we see, like let's say in optical, the profile of this jet. And this is the profile, spectral profile, different spectral indices, radio, infrared, to radio, optical, infrared. What we see is that even though there are changes, but there is like they are completely not correlated with the intensity changes. This is not what we expect if there is like each knot is a shock, and then we have acceleration and cooling, acceleration and cooling. And I'm really finishing. And okay, just because there was also talking about this bow shocks, and let me. So finally, the jets. We go to the end of the jet. Okay. Now, we go to the end of the jet, and there are terminal shocks, and we know that these are shock. What I wanted to say is that this is again the shock spectrum. And because of this observation, we could recover the energy energy distribution of the electrons. This is multiplied by gamma. And we see the same like in case of blazars when we think that they are relativistic shock, namely this is the spectrum. I just wanted to point out that that's what would we expect from the standard, let's say, expectation that we have, you know, shock Maxwellian plus a power law. This is what we see, really. We never see this kind of spectrum. This is what we see when we are kind of sure that this is the shock. And that's it. Just to put the slide. Okay, I have more slides, but I'm sorry.
You're going to put your whole collection of slides on this?
Yes.
Could you go back to the shock that didn't fit the spectrum, that right here? Uh-huh. So what were the parameters? Was it relativistic?
Okay, so
what do we know?
Mm-hmm. So these are the terminal shocks. So when the jet, powerful jet, interacts with the ambient medium, forms this kind of double shock structure that we think forward shock and reverse shock. The interesting thing is that we don't observe emission from this forward shock. We think that all the emission, that non-thermal emission we observe from this terminal hotspot is from the reverse shock. So this is the spectrum, and we obtain the Spitzer data and optical and Chandra, so we could really, you know, fit. We believe that they are mildly relativistic, so Lorentz factor few only. We observe polarization, we can, because they are, you know, resolved also in X-ray and even for Spitzer, and the depolarization indicates the magnetic field perpendicular shock. So this is mildly relativistic shock, and this is the spectrum, and so there is no beaming, let's say. We don't expect beaming.
It propagates in the jet material, right?
Yes, so this is this reverse shock. That's what we believe. But in fact, it's not that we observe the double shock structure, right? We observe just a blob, and we think that this is the, you know, downstream region of the reverse shock.
So that peak is MP over ME. So you think the jet material is protons?
Yes. So this is also consistent, as I said, because we were surprised, really surprised, because we thought that we will get the E to minus two spectrum that is modified by sort of absorption here and cooling here. But this is really not the case. The absorption effects come here, cooling effect here. So this is really the injected spectrum. And this is really the break that you cannot, you don't have much freedom. So we try different, for example, we tried shape E to minus two, but then we will overproduce optical limits. So therefore this different curves, right? So these are really kind of, we believe, and this is really this peak at the MP over ME. And by the way, because we have synchrotron and inverse compton, we can really say that there is a equipartition between magnetic field and electrons in this kind of, in this terminal shock. And also what is interesting that for this power, for this shape of spectrum, with this low energy spectral index, you have also equipartition rough with the protons if the number of electrons to proton is 10. And this is the same what we get from the blazar modeling on much smaller scale. So I think it's encouraging, this kind of agreement between the parameters. There is a big deal. I'm very interested actually in this process Hoshina and Aaron are talking, because there is principle one could measure by the slope some parameters of the plasma that otherwise are, you know, hidden, like the number density or temperature.
So just to clarify, this black line is the spectrum of electrons you infer?
Yes, for one hotspot and the other, they are on two different sides. So this is what we observe. And that's what I just put up, what we would expect, you know, in proton shock, people sometimes talk about, you know, not temperature coupling when the electrons are just heated, those thermal pool, let's say, to gamma, and then from power law, or some coupling, temperature coupling. There is, it seems like coupling, but let's say you don't form Maxwellian, it's just like a very flat power law.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
This is the spectrum of...
of electrons.
Okay, but that's the spectrum of radiation.
Yes, so from modeling the emission, this is the spectrum we have to have in order to fit the emission. So we apply for this data point, we apply Compton model, and in order to fit it, and like for example here the different lines is just because we tried different shape, like, you know, standard E2 minus 2, right? And then we overproduce, you know, just trying different. And so this is kind of, you know, this is what became the best representation of the electron spectrum that would explain this thing.
You talked about the blazar spectra being very hard, and I thought I heard that you had an argument against this being acceleration at a relativistic oblique shock, which is still subluminal. Is that true?
The high energy part of the blazar spectrum?
The lower energy part, which has a very hard spectrum.
Okay. Well, it's possible. The interpretation that these are these two different processes is just interpretation, right? So what we see is in many blazars, actually, and for example, Ghisellini and Celotti, when they are doing this massive leptonic fitting of many, many blazars, right? This is the spectrum they inject. Once again, this is of this form. You have to have a very flat.
Yeah, no, it was the interpretation. Shocks. You had an argument against it. No.
I was just saying that, you know, that's what we think. But of course, if you could make this kind of sharply broken power law as a pure diffuse shock acceleration, it would be very interesting to talk about this.
If no one else has, I have a question. So we just saw at the first talk today that there was kind of band-like spectrum, like in GRBs, we see this broken power law.
Mm-hmm.
So you also have this, but there the peak was at 2 GeV. Do you expect something similar?
I was not talking, these are the most recent Fermi results. For example, this modeling was with the EGRET data. So let's say that here, like we have this break at 100, and it seems, and this is steep, and this is, let's say, this is the effective spectral index. In fact, it would be like slightly flatter and slightly steeper around GeV. So instead of, you know, one break, in fact, it seems you have three breaks. So it makes it more complicated. But very roughly, it like for energetic doesn't matter because most of the power is here, right? So then you form some kind of, you know, complicated power law, but then it's steep anyway, right? Because the spectra that Craig was showing above this energy, above MeV, are steep anyway.
What if there were cooled electrons hanging around there from previous shocks? So you would have low energy particles filling in your deficit at the low end, and is it, would that help?
When you were
saying that the thermal does not have enough low energy particles.
So there are no constraints. As I said, all we see is the non-thermal emission from these jets. And we can put constraint, you know, whatever is the, like, for example, if you cool the electrons or if they from the beginning, in the case of blazar sources, you will see a radiative signature because of this bulk Compton. That's what you don't see. Well, sometimes we have, in fact, like here, some hint for like soft excess. The problem is that you can also feed it by extension of the synchrotron or SSC. So, but it's not important. The important is that the level of it, that is not huge. So, you know, you can then also eventually, I think that you could rather put constraints that you cannot just cool electrons, that you always, there is some heating of these low energy electrons forming a power law instead of, you know, some Maxwellian pool.
Okay, we're in session. Back here to learn.